Okay, we could begin. Tavro, that's... Is that all right? Yeah. Good afternoon. Ajahn Sumedho's just finished a teaching a 10-day retreat. I see some of the retreatants here. This is the wonder of Amaravati, I think, that there's so much Dhamma that we can share. It's quite a special place, a wonderful place. And this kind of occasion on a Sunday afternoon, I think, I always reflect how much goodness there is here, that all of us come together because we all love truth, whatever, you know, whatever particular way we define that, whatever tradition we have, whatever our search is, there's this love of truth, appreciation of truth, and coming together like that is very special, very special. And hopefully that lifts some of the cynicism of the age. I think it's a very cynical age, and one can get pretty depressed by it all, I suppose. And to do this, to come together and consider, not to take positions or on cups of tea and touching ground, but rather just to bring up that in the mind which loves truth, and then to stimulate that again and again and again. Truth for us is Dhamma. It's a special word in the Pali language. My grounding in truth comes from many teachers, so I would like to dedicate this talk to Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn Chah gave me the early inspiration and role model and energy to keep practicing my early years in Thailand, and Ajahn Sumedho has very much molded my practice and continues to do so. So I have tremendous gratitude for both of them. So it's, and gratitude is quite a lovely thing that we humans can experience, so why not bring it up into the mind? I have a practice that I do myself, I find very joyful, where I go, I do a little autobiography of the different people that have helped me on the path, and I bring up their images and I thank them. So I think of my parents, and then I think of someone in university, and someone I met in Spain, and someone I met in India, and Ajahn Chah and Sumedho, and so on. And this is a very to bring gratitude to mind is a very important part of freedom, I think. And that doesn't mean that we the kind of demand you should be grateful. That's not it. Just we have the power to think, and we think a lot, so why not think good things? So the reflection on gratitude is just that. Just think, bring up someone that's helped you and say thank you. It's quite simple, really. It just takes a bit of effort. So that's one kind of practice I like to do. Today's talk has been a joke in the monastery the last week. This title, a lot of people have given me suggestions. Drinking tea, touching ground. I've been trying to find the person who set the title. I think I know who it is. It's someone who obviously likes tea. But my own ponderings on this. This morning I was sitting here, right down here, on the ground drinking tea, considering what I might say. So I just drank my tea and touched the ground. And that was very peaceful, just to drink tea and touch the ground, just to do that, just to, in that very simple act of being. And that simplicity of being is something we often miss in life, don't we? I think partially because it's so busy. We tend to have so much to do. They promised us with mechanization that we'd have less to do, but I wonder if it really worked. I think we got ripped off in some way. So it's a busy, busy life. Also, I think modern life oftentimes is the sensual stimulation is very extreme. We have a lot of kind of extreme experiences. And so the simplicity of walking, of noticing a tree, of drinking a cup of tea, sitting on the ground, this simple beauty of that is often missed. As you know, in Buddhism, we emphasize the practice of mindfulness or the practice of awareness. And I think many people misunderstand that as to be a kind of a control. You know, like, you know, the guy says, okay, I got to drink my tea mindfully. Then you sort of drink your tea mindfully and hate the whole exercise. So there's an idea that it has to be something special. So you're going to hold the cup and put it up to your lips and try to be mindful and try not to think. And that's a kind of self-obsession, a self-consciousness, which is really isn't what we mean by mindfulness. But mindfulness is, again, a word I keep using, is that more like a sense of receiving or appreciating. Now, appreciation in Buddhism is appreciation of Dharma or the way things are. And this is different than aesthetic appreciation. So if I were an aesthete and I was drinking the tea this morning, you know, if the mug had a chip in it and had some kind of slogan from a factory saying that dill pickles are the best or something like that, I mean, well, this is a disgusting cup. I can't have my cup of tea in this. Or if someone had sort of passed the tea bag over the water and we got sort of a gray water, I could think, who made this cup of tea? And I do sometimes, I confess. But so that's more the aesthete or the person who likes a good cup of tea, and that's okay, but it's not liberating. I think if you know any aesthetes, if they have no Dharma, they suffer. In one of our monasteries, we spent a lot of time planting up trees. We had botanists telling us what the right mix of native trees would be. So we planted them out, and there was an aesthete that lived next door, and he got very upset. The trees haven't even grown yet. It was better than what was there before, but he got very upset because it wasn't his particular pattern. It wasn't the pattern that he wanted. Now, so that's aesthetics when we attach to it. Aesthetics, when they are used well, can be very beautiful. Say, I think this temple, for me, it's very beautiful, but it won't liberate me. It might make me a bit calmer, but the temple itself won't liberate me. So we can use architecture and we can use nice china cups and make a good cup of tea, but the appreciation a Buddha has is the appreciation which liberates. Okay? It's a different kind of appreciation. And so having, you know, drinking a cup of tea and touching the ground in the Buddhist sense would be to keep coming back to, as we say, the way things are. And this is the most obvious statement I think we can make as human beings. The way things are, this is the way it is now. But if we never bring ourselves to that very simple contemplation, we will never appreciate life as it is. And if we don't appreciate life as it is, we cannot understand it. And if we don't understand life, we cannot be truly happy. So obviously it's a basic requirement for freedom to appreciate this moment the way it is. So what we are endlessly trying to encourage each other to do here is to, when you walk, walk. When you sit, sit, but don't wobble. When you're having your cup of tea, have your cup of tea. When you're eating food, eat your food. Now, that's not just kind of controlling it, it's just actually doing it. It's the most simple thing. So like, say, walking from my room to here. If I'm walking with the intention of getting here, I never really walk. I get here, but the interim, that space in between, my mind is projected ahead, and I don't appreciate the way things are. I might trip and break my neck. I might get here 30 seconds quicker. But to actually appreciate, this is walking. This is standing. This is drinking. This is eating. This is talking. Why do that? I mean, why even bother? Because there's a tremendous beauty in that, first of all. But secondly, we begin to see what we're creating on top of this moment. And if we are not say, awake to this moment, and we are creating things on this moment, such as judgments and worries and aversions and annoyances and fears and doubts. We're creating on top of that, on top of this moment, we're creating all that, and we don't see that, then we get more and more entrenched in unnecessary suffering, and we hurt ourselves. And then eventually that goes outwards and we hurt others in various kinds of ways. So to actually bring awaken to this moment, say, I think this is what the word Buddha means for me, to awaken to this moment in its fullness, not as a judgment, and not necessarily how I want it to be or how I don't want it to be, but how it actually is. And it's rarely, you know, when I have a lot of desires and confusion, it's rarely the way I want it to be. But Buddhism is trying to point to the fact that why not find freedom with the way things are rather than look for something else? Desire is saying look for something else. So you get it every now and then, but then you keep having to look for something else. Say monastic life for us, for me, say my early years in Thailand, I went into monastic life with all the opportunities that a baby boomer in Toronto could have, which were quite a lot, actually. You know, I was a university student and all that, and traveled. And so I had a chance to chase things, to do things, to have crazy kind of experiences that one has in adolescence, and to have philosophical discussions with people and to travel and all that. But I really hadn't spent so much time just being. You know, there was so much of my life which was becoming. And that, you know, those early years are like that, aren't they? The years of exploration and such like. But no one ever told me just to stop and look, well, how is it? How is it now? What is it like? So I found that when I got into the monastery, I was always trying to rearrange my mind to the way I thought it should be, and to arrange the monastic schedule to the way I thought it should be. So I tended to tell Ajahn Chah in my own mind. I never told him outright. I was too afraid of him. But I always tell him how, you know, how the monastery should be, you know, how the chanting should be, or how the work schedule should be, and how the food should be. And failed to see, well, how is it? You know, how is it now? But the thing about monastic life, it's very much in a kind of skillful entrapment, and I found myself so often sitting and waiting, you know, like waiting for a meal, or waiting for a talk to begin, or waiting for a talk to end, or waiting for the Patimokkha to start, or waiting to go somewhere with a car, or waiting for the trip to finish, just kind of waiting around a lot. As much of Thailand was just sort of waiting around, especially like long discourses in a language I didn't understand. That brought up a lot of restlessness and aversion and things like that. And Ajahn Chah would just keep teaching the same thing. Why do you suffer? And he would just keep pounding away at this theme. And my Thai was minimal, but at least I could understand that. And just being trapped like that, hour after hour, day after day, where I couldn't get away, and I just had to watch, well, this is the way it is now, and it's going to be like this tomorrow, Virdhamma, and it could be like this the rest of your life. And just the fact that I couldn't get away, I couldn't chase my aesthetic preferences, or just kind of take off, jump the wall when I wanted to jump the wall. I mean, I could, but there was some determination in me. Just that I had to actually take this moment and begin to really look at it. What is it? What is it now? What's happening now? And then see, what am I laying on top of it? What am I putting on top of it? And those early lessons were so very powerful. Like, say, in Thailand, those years that I was with Ajahn Chah, the monastery is relatively poor. The food was very poor. But at least it was a sensual stimulation. Now, other than that, there was nothing. There was no, very few books. I love reading. There were very few Westerners. Sometimes I like talking. There was no coffee or tea. There was no music, obviously, monastic and so on. So the only thing each day was a meal. A meal. And the meal was sticky rice and a bit of fried fish and a mango or something like that. So it was very unspectacular. But when you don't have anything, this becomes very important. And so because this was the only thing where the senses could be stimulated, and I'd been so used to always stimulating the senses, not appreciating sense consciousness, but stimulating them, which my upbringing had allowed, that's all. I could just think about the meal all day. And you go, oh God, sticky rice, sticky rice, sticky, sticky. Big. I remember once I was a 25-year-old novice, a 6-foot novice. All the other novices were 12 years old and about 2 foot tall. So I was sort of this gangling Yank kind of Canadian at the end of the line and trying to look dignified. This novice next to me got an extra banana. And I was just enraged. Now there was something in me this is silly. I said, come on, here, now we'll grow up. You're 25 years old, it's just a banana. But something more profound in me wanted to steal his banana. And now that was because my whole... Now, I didn't think I had a food problem before that. And I didn't, because I could have food, or I could do all kinds of other things. Huh? So I had all kinds of outlets for sense distraction. So my attitude to the world of sense was more like going out into it to get something, or to get rid of something, to get the pleasant, to get rid of the unpleasant. But it wasn't until I was really forced into a situation where the usual outlets weren't there, where I was voluntarily trapped myself, that I had to just contemplate, well, this is the way it is now. And that was very helpful, because then I could see what I was creating on top of it. So like in the food thing, it was such a powerful lesson, because all the sense distractions which I had enjoyed before were now narrowed down to about 20 minutes a day. That was it. That and sleep. That was about the only sensual thing, and that was sticky rice and mangoes. And because it was so kind of condensed and narrowed down, I could really see the whole movement of the mind out into sense consciousness, seeking something. Always this movement out to seek distraction, but there was this only one thing. And then I could see when that was not satisfied, how that would be frustrated. So it was such a powerful lesson. And it's a lesson that's really was very profound, because it's about all of sense consciousness. Now, when we are sense beings, or that we are conscious through a sense body, so it's obviously very important that we understand sense consciousness, isn't it? Because we're sensitive. You know, we hear, we touch, we taste, we think, and so on. So, I mean, that's so important to understand that, rather than to chase that or be chased by it, isn't it? And so understanding is beginning to appreciate, this is the way it is now. It's this way now. From that, wisdom can arise. And from that, our mindfulness begins to be informed with wisdom. And we realize what the Buddha realizes. That's the whole way of practice. So, say, like in Thailand, just being there, like, we have this kind of tradition where one only starts the meal when the person before you, the more senior person, has started the meal. I was number 70 of 70. And Ajahn Chah used to play cat and mouse with us. Well, at least I thought so. He probably wasn't. I was just projecting onto him. But he'd sort of, like, we couldn't start until he started. We could cheat. It's just sort of stick in your mouth. But you sort of tried to be honorable. And so he'd shuffle around, and he'd move his cup there, and then he'd move it back. And then he'd move his spittoon, then he'd move it back. And I'd be down the line looking up. And it's just driving me crazy. And then, of course, he'd start, and then the other monks start. And there was always someone, some really sort of gung-ho new guy next to me who'd wait an extra 5 minutes. But what I began to just appreciate was, well, why don't you just sit here? What does it feel like to sit here? What does that feel? What does the mat feel like? Or what is the heat like? Or what is just the sound? And as I began to do that, I began to just appreciate, well, this is the way it is now. Sense consciousness is this way. Then I began to see how my mind was moving towards an experience, towards the experience of eating and getting something. And just that very movement of moving out towards getting something, as I began to see that, I began to find something about my real home, as Ajahn Chah would say. Something in my own consciousness which could be, in a sense, experience, but could be peaceful. Which wasn't always reaching out and getting and becoming and trying to acquire and get more of or hold on to. That very reaching is kind of restlessness of the mind that we have. And that reaching goes out into thought, it goes out into emotion. Because emotion is an object, isn't it? We say it's my emotions, it's my fear or my anger or whatever. But it is an object of mind. And attention reaches out into it and clutches it and gets caught up into it, just as you would reach out towards something. Now, it's okay to reach out. It's okay to have a cup of tea. But that's not spiritual. It's not religious in the sense of that very reaching mind is what we want to understand, because that's a restless mind. And vice versa, there's also pushing away, isn't there? Not only do I reach out into the sense world for getting some experience, and how much of our time is spent in the future, which is always in the present, how much of our thoughts are about what I'm going to do, and what I'm going to have, and so on. How much of our thinking mind is involved that way, which is a present activity. Well, there's that, but there's also the pushing away, isn't there? There's the shoving away of experience. And so all that negative part, which is a part of being sensitive, pain and loneliness and anxiety, and these are all part of being human. This is a part of being sensitive. When someone speaks to me in a really cruel way or puts me down in some way, I feel that. And that might, it hurts. It affects me. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you? Not true. Huh? Names can really hurt, can't they? So I am sensitive in that way. And to appreciate that, to actually appreciate that, means what? Well, when the negative happens to me, and it happens to this mind-body, when that happens, to begin to appreciate that, well, this is the way the mind-body is. It's sensitive, it feels. So that that whole tendency to deny the negative, to push it away, to run away from it, to think it shouldn't be there, to think I'm sick, to think I'm neurotic, when these things happen, to just see, well, that's the way it is now. Life is this way. When we have hearts and bodies and minds, we are affected in this way. So in terms of awareness, to receive and be aware of all of that of life. And again, we can move away from pain, and we can try to create good environments and good relationships to create happiness in our lives, but that's not a spiritual refuge, because it's very tentative, it's very dependent on other things. So we have this push and pull going on in sense consciousness. And sense consciousness is constructed that way. It's a given. You can't get away from that. Okay? And that's a fundamental thing that we have to constantly realize about sense consciousness. And because there is this push and pull going on, the Buddha said that very push and pull, if you follow that, you're always going to be led around by the nose. The sense world is going to push and pull, push and pull, push ad nauseum. From birth after birth after birth. So that isn't the place of freedom. So the aesthete or the sensual person or the self-judging and self-hating person, the very good person who's very self-judging and self-hating, that person can never be free, because that person is always looking at objects, pushing away, holding on to pulling, you know, this kind of energy that we get caught up into. Like for any of you who are meditators, observe how when you're meditating, how when there's a lot of thought, you try to get rid of the thought. I mean, I've been through a lot of that myself, where you're meditating and you focus on the breath, or you do your mantra, and after 10 minutes you realize that you've been out to lunch for 10 minutes, you know, just gone. And then, gotta stop thinking. Yeah? And right there, there is an appreciation of the way things are. There's the struggle of becoming someone who doesn't think. A noble effort, but it won't work. Because thinking is a part of having gray matter. So unless we have a lobotomy, or whatever, lobotomize ourselves with drugs or whatever, thinking is going to be a part of it. It's a part of it. And yet, one of the things which very much takes us away from the way things are is thought, isn't it? We're going to have thought, and yet thought is which tends to take us away from the cup of tea into all kinds of realms, in often unskillful realms. So what many of us have when we have a cup of tea is we have a thought sandwich, don't we? We make a meal of it, don't we? Okay, so how can we, and if you're a meditator and you're contemplating your inner world and you're observing, I think we all see that so much of thought is unskillful, destructive, and useless, and a dulling of that clarity of the mind when there is a emptiness of all that. So an important part of Buddhist practice is the awareness of thought. It's the understanding of thought, it's right thinking and abandoning wrong thinking, very, very much. And in terms of having a cup of tea, to actually if one keeps bringing this kind of reflection to appreciate the way things are, this is the way it is now, then I'll notice the thoughts. Right? If I never do that, I'll never notice the thoughts, and I'll have the cup of tea, but my mind will just be going on in the old habitual forms. And the true joy of the quiet mind will pass me by. I'll be absorbed into the thinking process. And that's one of the big hindrances to the spiritual life, is not understanding thought. My first entry into Buddhism was through Krishnamurti, and I read a book, and I had a very, really deep experience through reading the book in India, and then I got myself into the robe, which is a nice contradiction with Krishnamurti, but I won't go into that. But I did honor his way of awareness. But I kind of picked up the idea that I had to stop thinking. And I had, I remember, one of the reasons I got into monasticism was I had this memory as a child of the mind being very silent and still. And I always wanted to get back to that. And the way I tried to get back to that was through distraction. And then it wouldn't work. I'd say, oh, this isn't it. And I'd feel this kind of frustration. And then I'd keep looking for that inner silence. So that's always been a profound thing, a motivating factor for me since childhood. But so I got into monasticism, and then the first formal question I asked Ajahn Chah was, so how do I get rid of all this noise? All this darn thinking, this blah, 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 all day and all night too. How do I get rid of it? And I used the words, how do I get rid of it? And he said, well, look at this Buddha here. And he said, that Buddha's made of wood, right? And it hasn't moved for years. So you want to be like that, don't you? Sit there and not think. Now, obviously, you've got a thinking mind. And if you stimulate in thinking ways, it's going to think. So that helped me to not repress it, to not repress the thoughts. And then to not indulge in the thoughts, I've used often the way of asking who is thinking, of seeing where the thought comes from, or using Ajahn Sumedho's ideas of the space around thought, or the space between thought, or bringing up a thought deliberately, and then seeing the end of a thought, and seeing before the thought. Now, I think this in the spiritual life is very important, because that for me, that still center of knowing, the still center of being, is not a sense experience. It's not hot or cold. It's not big or small. It's not pain or non-pain. It's not fear or non-fear. It's something that somehow is within it and transcends it. That's still center of being. And I've often, and I continue to use, just like in my meditation or just in the daily life, I really try to put a lot of attention and noticing the I thought, or the me thought, or the me and my thought. In other words, what am I going to talk about today? So the way I prepared this talk, sometimes I'll prepare a theme, but the way I prepared this talk was, each time my mind began to think about cups of tea and touching the ground, I'd ask myself, who's thinking? Now, I didn't expect to find an answer. Viradamo's thinking, a Latvian Canadian's thinking, Theravada monk is thinking, because then you can just say, well, who said that? But this sense of questioning thought brings you to no thought. At least that's what I use, one of the things I use. So as my mind started to bubble over with this kind of just slightly anticipation kind of thought about the future, I used that very, very theme to look at no thought. So I'd say, like, who's thinking? Who's planning? And when I really bring my mind to that sense of attentiveness and observation, the mind goes silent. If I try to find a thinker, I'll end up in a psychiatric hospital. Because you can't find anything. All there is being. But that very question, or that very looking at thought, I found for myself a way of not repressing thoughts, but seeing the space around them, seeing the gap between them, and beginning to appreciate non-thought. Not in a way of getting rid of thought, because thought's a necessary part of life, and it's an echo that exists because I do think and I plan and such like. But to see the silence of the mind, to begin to witness to that, to experience, to taste that, not to experience, but to know that, because it's there all the time, actually, because thought is an object. You are not the thinker. It's an object which comes and goes according to conditions. So that if one can begin to touch that space and know that space, then one begins to know that space when one is drinking tea and touching ground. There is just this, just that, just this drinking of the tea. Or when one is like experiencing strong emotions, one goes to that very feeling. Who's feeling anger now? One can fully feel the anger in the silence of the mind. One can fully be with that feeling in the spaciousness of the mind, because that kind of investigation which brings us to no thought brings us to space rather than to the objects. Brings you, space is just a way of talking about it, brings you to something which isn't conditioned by sense experience. And that's, I think, for me at least, this is where the religious life is. This is where the spiritual life. It's not in experience, because all experience is positive or negative. It has a push and pull. It's good or bad. It's big or small. It's dualistic. But behind it, around it, and all through it is this sense of knowing and being and spaciousness and silence. And that has to be, in some sense, we have to surrender into that. You can't get that. Now, the desire mind is something which is always trying to get something, isn't it? Like the desire mind wants to get rid of discomfort. Fine, that's what it's there for. You put your hand on the stove, and the stove is on. Your desire mind takes your hand off the stove, protects you. That's fine. So the desire mind is looking for objects, objects of sense, objects of experience, looking for happiness and trying to get rid of unhappiness, which is okay. I'm not saying that's wrong. But the desire mind can never find that which is not a function of desire, not a function of sense consciousness. And that's why we put so much emphasis on understanding desire, understanding that very movement out into all the objects of sense that we tend to get caught up into, understanding that desire is the way it is. It's a part of nature. But by believing in that, we'll not find liberation. We won't find that profound stillness of the heart which religion talks about, because the desire mind is looking for that which is always changing. It's very restless. So the abandonment of that strategy is not a denial of desire, but it's appreciating desire, what it can give and what it can't give. Appreciating desire. So desire can give you a nice cup of tea. And that's all right. One of the monks that was with me those first years in Thailand, Ajahn Brahmawangso, who's the abbot of the monastery in Perth, he's a brilliant man, and he's a physics graduate from Cambridge. And I think one of the things that really kept me going in Buddhism was that anytime a novice or a layperson would come into the monastery, he'd teach them how to make a proper cup of tea. And this is probably why I'm here now, because it sort of kept me going through those difficult times. So he'd sit them down, and he'd say, warm the pot first, etc., etc., etc. And we had lovely cups of tea. But that wasn't liberation, because as soon as I had the first one, I wanted a second one. Or I'd begin, you know, we'd only have that once a day, and I didn't have any access to tea bags or anything, so it was kind of, if it was there, it was there. If it wasn't, it wasn't. So certainly it wasn't liberation. Huh? So that's the desire mind. But I appreciated the cup of tea. There's nothing wrong with that. It was really delightful. But it wasn't freedom. It wasn't liberation. So in a sense of appreciating the way things are, we have to appreciate, what is the desire mind for? What is desire around the sense realm? What's its function? It has a function. It has a usefulness. We can create beautiful spaces. And we can have uplifting music, or we can have beautiful art and so on. And they can be, you know, they can help the religious life. They can be addictions. They can bind us closer. But that the liberation of the human heart is a transcendence of that whole business. So if I could just leave you, there's a difficult little sutta from the texts, which is probably the most dense statement of practice that I've come across in the texts, and not that I've read it very thoroughly, but this is to an ascetic called Bahiya. And Bahiya was an ascetic who probably lived, the commentaries say, I think in Western India, and he was really a highly attained yogi, thought he was a fully enlightened being, and another ascetic spoke with him and said, I don't think you're fully attained, but there is a Buddha who lives on the eastern side of India. And Bahiya was very, very inspired by the idea of a Buddha existing in this age, and so he walked across the width of India. So pilgrimage in those days was a bit more difficult. You couldn't jump a 747, and you had to really put some effort in. So the texts say that he never spent more than one night in one place, and he finally reached Sawati, and he went to the monastery, sought out the Buddha. It was the morning, and the monks were on alms round. And so the story goes that he went into the town trying to find the Buddha, and he saw the Buddha on alms round, and he dropped to his feet, and he asked for some teaching from the Buddha. He was very, very inspired and obviously fired up. And the Buddha tried to indicate it was really not quite the time for teaching now. It's time for alms round. And Bahiya pleaded, and then the Buddha said a second time, well, it's not the correct time, and Bahiya said a third time, and you know how the texts go, always in the third time, something happens. So the Buddha said, now if I can get it right, Bahiya, here's a training in brief. Bahiya, you should train thus. In the seen, there should be just the seen. In the heard, there should be just the heard. In the sensed, there should be just the sensed. In the cognized, there should be just the cognized. So you should train thus, okay? And when Bahiya, in the seen, there is just the seen. In the heard, there is just the heard. In the sensed, there is just the sensed. In the cognized, there is just the cognized. Now the difficult part. Then Bahiya, you will not be that by which. And when you will not be that by which, then you will not be in that place. And when you will not be in that place, you will be neither here, nor yonder, nor in between. And this is the end of suffering. Now that last bit's very difficult. You will not be that by which, to me, refers to the whole wrong view we have of who we are. That I am the sense body. And the attachment and the involved in that with our emotions and our seeking of sense experience, all of that is what makes it so difficult for us. And when in the scene there is just the scene, there is suchness, we say suchness. In the herd there's just the herd. In the cup of tea there's just a cup of tea. In touching ground there's just a touching ground. What do we touch? Or what do we realize? For me, I realize something which is very still, very present, but not a part of all that. That's not who I really am. In the seen, there should be just the seen. In the sensed, there should be just the sensed. Then there will not be that by which. Then you will not be in that place. Then you will be neither here, nor yonder, nor in between. Now this is something that you can actually do. You can actually practice that way. You know, you can just say that sight is this way. Whether it's an ugly sight or a beautiful sight, you can notice. So if it's a beautiful sight and your mind starts to grasp it and crave it and keep it, you can notice that. And that knowing is transcending the desire. Or it can be an ugly sight and you can see that. And the scene is just the scene. And the ugly sight is making one angry or irritated or annoyed. And that can be known. And that knowing is transcending the desire or the aversion. In the scene, there should be just the scene. In the cognizer, just be cognized. Like the emotions that we go through as human beings, this is just anger. Anger just feels this way. Huh? It just feels that way. Suchness. That's very hard, isn't it? Not to blame yourself or to blame someone else. Jealousy is just this way. It feels this way. And to have faith and trust in that is hard because we are so addicted to desire. We want to be good people. We have ideals. We're usually people who come, you're very good people. And so if any kind of wonky bit comes up in your consciousness, you think, ooh, I'm terrible. But it's just a wonky bit, that's all. It's not who you are. You don't own that. And there's such a relief in realizing that that's not who you are. It just comes up because the conditions are that way. You know, so if you feel totally like wonky, that's all. It's just, you feel totally wonky. It's just the way it is, isn't it? And what a relief. You don't have to be straight. You can be wonky. Huh? Because we spend so much of our time just trying to shuffle the furniture, don't we? You get on the furniture, right? Okay, there's happiness. There's I've got compassion going. I got some calm going. It's just right. And then the wonky bits come up. Oh, gosh, it's not working. So religion becomes such a tiresome thing, trying to be good all the time. On a moral level, we have to be good. But as just in this transcendent way of looking and being, in the scene, there should be just the scene. Now, I found when I can just have faith in that, like if I feel, if some old wonky bit comes into consciousness, and I just know that as Dharma, appreciate that as a Dharma, and Dharma is just truth of the way things are, not mine, then it tends to not be a problem. You know, my mind doesn't make a problem out of it. And there's a kind of naturalness about that, a naturalness of experience in that, that we try to encourage. So the path of mindfulness is really a natural way of living. It's not a controlled way of living. It's not a self-conscious way of living. It's not a self-obsessed way of living. And it's always in the context of moral responsibility, of social responsibility. Okay, I'll leave that for reflection. We can have a cup of tea, touch the ground, and return for questions in a few minutes. Thank you. So if you guzzle your tea down, no, you can drink your tea slowly. Touch ground, drink tea. Cliff asked me a question I could maybe get things rolling with. The word unconscious is something that you don't usually see in Buddhism. So Cliff was asking, do we have such a word in Buddhism? I'm not sure. That's a safe answer. But there are two words which I use a lot for the idea of things coming up into consciousness from some space that we are not aware of. And they are, there are three words: defilement, which is kilesa, anusaya, which is latent tendency, and asava, which is kind of like an outpouring, pouring out. And the theory is that if human beings engage in the sense world in a way which is bound by delusion in any way, bound by ignorance, then what builds up in the psyche somehow, somewhere, and I don't know what the mechanism is, what builds up are habit tendencies. And when situations arise, those habit tendencies can be triggered off. And the more heedless one is, these habit tendencies, not only do they become more strong, but they recur more often. In other words, let me give an example. Say, if I, let's say, for some reason as an adolescent, I get into just acting out my anger. So I get annoyed at someone, and I just believe in the annoyance, and I yell at them. And then I just do that. Every time anger comes, I feed it like that. Then that becomes a latent tendency, right? And when the situation is appropriate and annoyance is triggered off, then not only do I come out with anger, but I come out with anger more often and more strongly. And this sort of coming out with anger, say, is what we call asavas. It's the outpourings of delusion. And one of the ways we talk about nibbana or liberation in Buddhism is the end of the asavas, the end of these kind of ignorant in the sense of deluded, in the sense of confused and non-understanding. When these outpourings of greed, hatred, delusion cease, that's one way we talk about the liberation of the human mind, about nibbana. So, like, where are these stored? Is there a store? How does that work? I don't really know. There are ideas like in which I've read about, which I have not experienced, so I don't like to speak so much about them. But I think we can all see that given the right situation, it's the old kind of, you know, press my buttons, something's going to come up into consciousness. So when your buttons do get pressed, it's very important to work it out then. Because if I'm with someone who, you know, happens to make me annoyed, and let's assume it's a moral situation, it's life threatening and so on, then if I can just get beyond me and this other person and get more deeply into my heart, I can see now's a chance to work out the annoyance. Now's a chance to take that latent tendency and not feed it anymore, not buy into it anymore, so that my mind doesn't kind of pour outwards in a way of anger. And this is why, like in the contemplative life, we're trying to get beyond the objects of our latent tendencies. In other words, if I'm talking about anger, say, if I hate this person and that person and the government, and I hate the cat and I hate the dog and I hate the workers, the objects of hate are different. But the latent tendency towards hate, that's the same, right? So what we're trying to do in the contemplative life is depersonalize the whole thing. Not depersonalizing in the sense of being irresponsible, but we're trying to get beyond that I hate you, or I hate him, or I hate her, to just this is hatred. Hatred feels this way. And when I can recognize hatred feels this way, and not invest the personality view in it, we call it, or the ego view, or the I thought into that, That's the beginning of the end of hatred. Because what feeds the hatred is my identity attachment to it. So the way, if we're talking about hatred, say, the conditions are right, that triggers off the latent tendency. The latent tendency becomes manifest in consciousness, becomes conscious. If there is wisdom, this is the way anger feels, and there's patience and all the other things one needs, and it has a chance to cease. If there's ignorance, one takes it personally and says, either I shouldn't be angry, I'm a terrible person for being angry, and feels guilty and hates oneself, or the other, one acts on the anger and believes in it and blames the person and yells and carries resentment on, and so on. So those are the two extremes of repression and indulgence. And the middle way is to know this is the dharma of anger. Then that latent tendency has a chance to cease. And certainly there are things that come up into my conscious mind which will come up tomorrow, which aren't here now. And what the physiology or that is, I don't know where that's stored, I don't know, but I certainly know how it works in that way. That's so... So what is, you know, dreams and things like that, I don't, you know, all that realm, I've never investigated that. But I mean, it's just how we work very immediately. All right? Anyone else, anything? No. Because some of the stuff are just soap bubbles. Doesn't have to be repression. Surely, you know, we've all seen that. You see, feel annoyed at someone, you think, oh, it's not worth it, you let go. So I think, you know, I do get a feeling in Western culture that we sometimes think that by turning away we're repressing. But not necessarily. You can turn away skillfully. And I'm not saying that you can also repress by turning away. I mean, it can be done, but not necessarily. It's not an absolute. Lots of stuff is just soap bubbles. You just look at it and just don't make it a problem. It's poof, it's gone. But this comes from experience. And I guess for me, the test is it working in the long run? You know, is the heart happier and more loving and more free in the long run? If it's not, if there's a kind of consistent latent tendency stuck, then I say, man, I gotta look at this more carefully. What am I doing with it? Yeah, yeah. It, arise, endure, and cease. That's the difficult bit. That's the tricky number. You negotiate it with you. I will let you arise if you drop dead. Instead of, then I'll be all right. It's the endurance. Anything else? Just down the road. rare if it is. I think, why is that? I guess because it's like, it's not a doctrinal system. It's more about nature. So if you know, we always, if you're contemplating nature, you're a Buddhist. But to actually, like, to take up Buddhism formally, one undertakes to live by the precepts. So there's a kind of moral commitment if one's, you know, I'm going to be a Buddhist. But the whole idea of having to convert, like people say, I converted to Buddhism. I converted to truth. You know, it never makes sense to me. They always ask me, what was your religion? And I say, Lutheran. We went to church every other year. You know, so, I mean, it wasn't religion. It was some kind of social thing that my parents did very infrequently. And then say, oh, you converted to Buddhism. But it's sort of, I mean, I wear the gear and all that of a Buddhist monk, but it's not like a, It's about truth. It's about the way things are.
Yeah. So if I hear truth couched in a Sufi way, or a Christian mystic way, or in a psychotherapeutic way, or in a paleontological way, or whatever, it's still truth for me. But I mean, the thing about the Buddhism is it has a goal, and that's a freedom from suffering. So it's a particular aspect of truth. So I've never had to knock on doors, thank goodness. As a Buddhist monk, we're not allowed to speak unless invited, which is great. In Thailand, they'll say, like if a person's religious, the Thais will say, rather than what religion are you, they say, oh, wonderful, you're religious. Because religion implies morality. Which is, it's a whole different, it was really lovely in Thailand to see that attitude. It was quite nice. One wants to help, but there has to be an open door. And people, I think through experience, probably the Buddha saw that people won't take teaching unless they make an invitation. So there is compassion, wanting to help. So what we try to do is more create opportunities where people can participate. So like this kind of situation is an opportunity that we create and people can participate. Like the whole monastery is that. And it keeps us busy. I mean, we wouldn't have time to knock on doors. But so there is compassion there, but it's trying to make sure that there's an open door. So certainly if someone asks for the teaching, we try to share it. But it's interesting in our rules, the asking has to be respectful. Some drunk comes up to me and say, hey man, what are you? Forget it. But I think in that vein, one has to also, because I've certainly got burnt out trying to help, trying to fix everyone's karma. And I've, just had to find the balance between, not only is there compassion, but there also has to be equanimity. And that, that's taken me a long time to find, because I could certainly empathize with people, but then I'd get caught, I'd attach to the empathy, and then I'd, try to fix things which were unfixable or, which were beyond my powers or whatever. So compassion needs to be balanced with what can be done. That's often brought sadness to my heart, that I, they can't do anything. But then I say, yeah, but life has sadness too. And you're going to feel that sadness of being hopeless in a situation where you'd like to help, and going to that. It's just a part of our human existence. Otherwise, one can get very, any of us who are in the kind of helping professions, I think we've all been through that one. Our Buddha goes up next week. We have a plinth built in the new hall. And the floor, the people doing the floor are coming in Friday, a whole team of them. And we have to have the Buddha on the plinth by Friday night, I think. So this thing weighs a ton. The stone goes in the middle of the floor. There's a hole in the middle of the floor. There's a ceremony that Alina's talking about there. In the hall, there'll be a hole in the middle of the floor for a long time, and in this hall there's a boundary with nine spheres, stone spheres, big spheres in the ground. Religion does these strange things, so you can't see them. And And they mark the boundary of ordination, and actually the boundary is also the posts in there. And then in that, in the center of that square, there's a hole, and there'll be a stone sphere will be suspended above that for probably a whole year, I think. And then when we have the grand opening, which is usually quite a ways down the line probably, then someone like the King of Thailand's sister or someone like that might come and have a little mechanism where this stone is lowered into the ground. And that's the final ceremony for consecrating the hall. And I don't really know what it means. I still have to figure that one out. It's an ancient, it's called Luk Nimit. It's an ancient ceremony that they do in Thailand. And so hopefully many of you will have a chance to be a part of that. That's right. Yeah, that's right, in that square. That's right, yeah, right in the center. Okay, thank you for your attention. And I think Lompa is giving the next talk next Sunday. I'm not sure. I think I have to give the last one because he's... Yeah, the heat... there's a change of plan. Lompa decided to go to San Francisco on me. So I think I'll give the final talk.